Ben Schott writes the blog Schott's Vocab for The New York Times. It's his job to troll the internet for new and noteworthy words, whether they live a day or a year. Schott talked to Steve Paulson. He says words tell us volumes about the times we live in.
Ralph Waldo Emerson said language is the archive of history. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, I'm glad you asked me. I'm sure a lot of Emerson scholars would be thrilled that I'm going to answer on his behalf. I suspect he was communicating what I hope in a very small way I can carry on, this notion that the way we use language says a tremendous amount about the times in which we live. And of course, you know, language changes. It's this sort of endless, I mean, the people who would want language stuck in aspic and who get very, very agitated about new words or neologisms or about new usages of old words must realize that, of course, language is constantly changing. And even a word like nice, for example, horrendously overused by children, and it's kind of lost all its meaning. It had a completely different meaning 150 years ago. You know, a nice distinction meant a very kind of mean-minded and finickety one, whereas nice nowadays just seems a sort of bland, you know, any word catch-all. So I think Emerson was saying that, you know, we have to look at language and we have to sort of capture it on the fly because it tells us about the times in which we live.
So is that what you are doing with your Schott's Vocab for the New York Times? You're looking to sort of catch this moment in history?
Well, I hope so. I mean, the Schott's Vocab blog was designed really to be a way of filtering news stories by looking at language. So either they are words that suddenly just appear because they just hit the news, or they are words from another culture, a different language, which tells us something odd about, you know, another aspect of the world.
Now, language is this incredibly liquid medium. I mean, constantly changing and new words pop up. Are you looking for the particular words and phrases that will stick?
I think so. Or words that tell us something about the time in which we live. I mean, sometimes the words that I select are clearly words that are just going to die and they just had a moment. And, you know, they're not particularly vital, but they do tell us something. I mean, you know, hope, the notion of hope and the notion of change around Obama's election. Now, these aren't particularly new words, quite the opposite. And then Sarah Palin comes and asks, how's that hopey-changey thing working out for you? Hopey-changey thing. I mean, just now, in 10 years, what I hope is you'll read this, you'll go back and you'll think, oh, I remember that. And often it's the footnotes that you really remember. And, you know, the idea of hopey-changey, it was a wonderfully cynical parody of Obama's lexicon. And it just absolutely nailed a moment when people thought, well, I don't know, maybe Obama isn't quite what we maybe hoped he might be.
And it seems like a lot of the new words have to do with technology. I mean, is this sort of an especially rich mine of words for you?
I think so. I mean, technology is interesting because, of course, we are forced to take on new words because they're in new concepts. I mean, the notion of, say, Wi-Fi, you know, it's astonishing how quickly this has just entered the world. And, you know, for anyone who travels for business or needs to be in touch, the first thing you ask a hotel is, have you got Wi-Fi? 10 years ago, they'd stared blankly at you. Many hotels in Britain still stare blankly at you. But technology is a huge driving force, partly because technology creates new thought processes. I mean, the notion of Bluetooth, and as I said, Wi-Fi, and texting, and SMSing, and tweeting, and poking, Facebook has an entire new vocabulary of words. In the same way, and I have to say personally, I object to this, in the same way that if you go into certain coffee chains, you're forced to use their language. And of course, let's not forget that all brainwashers, the first thing brainwashers do is make you use their terminology. And ordering a grande, I think, of any kind of coffee is probably akin to brainwashing as far as I'm concerned.
I agree with that. That always rubs me the wrong way when I go into Starbucks. And, you know, since when is the little one the grande? Isn't it?
You know what? I don't know. I go in and say, I want a small black coffee, please. And I will just stare at them. I will stare them down. And they'll say a grande or whatever. And I'll say, no, I want a small black coffee. And, you know, I have the money in my hand, so I'm going to win. But it is true. Quite a lot of these new words I'm not particularly happy with. There was one that was quite pleasing, and this came from China, amongst China's young internet users, this Oh My Lady Gaga, which is apparently the modern replacement for OMG, Oh My God, as a way to express shock, hilarity, or to emphasize a point. So all around the internet in Japan, Chinese netizens, as they're called, citizens on the net, are typing Oh My Lady Gaga.
So it's sort of Oh My God, but with an ironic tone.
One would hope so. Oh my God, but with slightly fewer clothes on. It's hard to say.
Now, does a word ever actually change the way we think about something?
I mean, there are absolutely words. Something like boomer, for example, the greatest generation, it certainly sets a tone. And I think there are words that somehow they hit a moment and they can communicate something and they do last. Often, I mean, what's difficult about writing a blog is finding them and spotting them when you hear them. I mean, quantitative easing, for example, a very kind of strange Rococo phrase that essentially means printing more money. It's one of those weird little phrases that came in and actually has a huge, massive symbolic impact as to what's happening in the economy. And QE is a sort of technical term that's been around and economists have used it for years. And it's often interesting when technical words, for whatever reason, either, say, the pandemic, I mean, H1N1, a technical term suddenly was everywhere. And so quite often, they're technical terms that, for whatever reason, often ill, enter into the mainstream and change the way people think.
And then there are entirely non-technical terms like yakka wow.
Yeah, yakka wow, a great phrase that was actually a mishearing. It's a portmanteau of yuck and wow. And in the Times, they were quoting Baroness Greenfield, who's a neuroscientist, and they thought she said yakka wow, and she said yuck and wow. And it seemed to capture people's imagination, and the yakka wow meme went everywhere. And I don't know, I quite like mishearings and overhearings. It was a glorious moment when George Bush was at a big international state event with Tony Blair, and they both had their microphones on, and Bush walked up to Blair and said, "Yo, Blair." And for the British media, that was just, it summed up everything that they thought about Blair's sort of poodle-like relationship with George Bush.
Of course, I mean, the thing that's frustrating in a way is that, you know, you hear these stories about political gaffes and things that people shouldn't say, even if they really believe them. And, you know, the conclusion you have to come to is they should use the blandest language possible, because otherwise it'll get them in trouble.
Well, what you realize, and you only have to look at, say, the healthcare debate in America, what you realize is that the words politicians use are, I think quite sadly, focus grouped to death. And you only have to look at the notion of the phrase death panel, an astonishingly powerful phrase that really captured people's imagination. And there are highly paid, very talented consultants who literally spend their days putting phrases, talking points to focus groups to try and get the exact phrase. You know, if you call something a tax, that's one thing. If you call it a rebate, that's another. If you call it an allowance, I mean, you know, the notion of redefining, as they did in Britain, unemployed to job seeker. Well, it's a very, very interesting definition. And you only have to look at, you know, the work of George Orwell to realize that politics and language are hugely intertwined. And I don't think politicians are speaking in more banal terms. I think they're speaking in much more coded terms. In Australia, there's this phrase, dog whistle politics, which is a way of speaking about, say, race or religion or abortion in a coded way. So it sounds reasonable, but people who know what you're talking about know the phrases you're using. And I think political language gets more and more complicated and more subtle, and it makes it harder for, you know, the average Joe voter to know exactly what's going on and to know the extent to which they're being manipulated.
So to go back to that example in England, trying to replace unemployment with job seeker, did that work? I mean, did job seeker catch on?
Well, it's interesting. You often get politicians talking about the unemployed and then stopping themselves and saying, I mean, job seekers. We had something called the community charge, which was a hugely unpopular tax that was called the poll tax, and there were poll tax riots. And the party that brought it in were under strict instructions never to refer to it as the poll tax. But every now and again, it slipped out because the good phrase will. I don't know. I think as voters, we need to be very, very careful about how language is co-opted and to the extent we're being manipulated. I think in some ways, the right is very good in America. You only have to look at Sarah Palin's language to realize how clever it is. And both Sarah Palin and George Bush had this sort of myth of folksy language, plain spoken. It was all about, you know, down at home. This is the way we speak. And it's not plain spoken. It's incredibly subtle and very, very well articulated. And I think we ignore that at our peril. We ignore the fact that language is incredibly powerful at our peril.
Do you think language is becoming globalized, at least these words in English?
Oh, I mean, without any doubt. I mean, quite a lot of the words on the Schatz Vocab blog come from Japan, India, China. Often they're at countries where there's an intersection between English and Indian. So there's Indian English and there's a fantastic amount of Chinglish, which is Chinese English. If I just look through some of the recent words on the blog that have come from China, you realize how many there are. And often they seem quaint and strange, but they really do tell us something about, you know, the notion of globalization. There's one actually from Haiti, one of my favorite terms that was on the blog, which is actually quite disturbing, but it sums up what I hope the Shots Vocab blog does. It was acid battery, spelled A-S-I-D-B-A-T-R-Y. And it stood out because it was such a curious misspelling, and it's a kind of pidgin English spelling of acid battery. And it's used in Haiti to describe the pain of starvation, because starvation feels like acid battery in the stomach. And it was an astonishing phrase, because I thought, well, A, this is really interesting. B, it's very curious, the pidgin English, the way the English is sort of, you know, casualized. And C, sorry, there's a famine in Haiti? I just didn't know this. And so often words give you little insights into, you know, how other cultures and other countries are living. It's very strange.
Hmm. Now, going through your Shots Vocab, there are these, well, there are just so many great phrases that seem to capture the moment. Fat finger trades, for instance.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of dispute about this. I don't know if any of your listeners realize, but the stock markets around the world plummeted. Just astonishing, a free fall for a very short period of time before rebounding. And there still is a lot of debate and dispute about why this happened. And there's all sorts of conspiracy theories, as you can imagine. But one of the theories was this so-called fat finger trade, which is a slang expression used amongst traders, which is essentially a mistyping. And there was a question of whether somebody mistyped millions for billions or vice versa, and this caused shares to plummet. Now, this has been denied. There's a Simpsons episode, I think, where Homer Simpson gets very obese and his fat fingers mean, I think there's a meltdown in the Springfield nuclear plant. maybe they knew exactly what they were writing about.
Well, and then there's another phrase, maybe related, suicide cuisine.
Suicide cuisine is wonderful, and quite a lot of my favorite words are food-related because it just seems an endless source. Suicide cuisine was a phrase, I think a Wired journalist created it, and it's glorious. It was used, I think, to sum up foods like, now KFC have a double-down burger. Now, I think I'm right in saying what they've done is they've taken the bold decision that burgers and sandwiches really aren't doing their job because of all of that bread. So what happens if you took the bread and you replace that with fried chicken? So you have a fried chicken, fried chicken sandwich, which is kind of genius when you think about it. It's amazing we survived as a civilization without dispensing with bread. So yeah, the suicide cuisine was just one of many horrific examples of food that we really shouldn't be eating.
One of my favorite words that I came across on your blog is, I don't know if I'm saying this right, the faux-amiens, the fake bohemians.
Oh, yes, the Fomians. As far as I remember, this was an attempt to redefine the word hipster. I think Gorka had decided that hipster was dead and we didn't need hipster anymore. So the Fohemians was an example. I think this is true. I think, well, it's interesting, the sort of hipster, the hipster look that you certainly get around areas in New York, and I'm sure lots of other places, Seattle and Portland, just spring to mind. You know, these people who appear to have lots of high-end Apple Mac products and no real job.
Ben Schott writes the Shots Vocab blog for the New York Times. He's also the author of the Shots Almanac series. Steve Paulson spoke with him.